Hello, friends, and it has been a little while since I've been able to come back to you here. Today is the 29th of August, 2021, and we're beginning on page 86 with Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 1, Section 1. Part 8, Video Commentary. The world is racked by crisis after crisis. I suppose we have to expect that as we move forward toward the Great Conclave of 2025. The forces of opposition will, of course, do all they can to influence the consciousness of the relatively ignorant people affected by the mass consciousness, and also those emerging into the strictly personality stage of consciousness. It is problematic in the extreme, and I'm hoping that when you have a chance to listen to this, whether it's shortly or in years to come, there has been some amelioration of the problem. I expect that that will come, but not before people suffer sufficiently. It's the way, it seems, of humanity. Suffer sufficiently to correct their ways. Now, in our little segue here, DK is telling us we have to think in terms of humanity, to aim at a wide open simplicity, and which waits expectant of that new thing which is so ready today to precipitate, but which is being hindered, and may I say, this is the shocking statement, which is being hindered from doing so by the idealists of the world, far more than by the man in the street. The man in the street perhaps represents that mass consciousness. But the idealists, too, they have their share in the delay. And DK uses the words far more. Anyway, he goes on to say the latter, that is, may I say, the man in the street, is simpler in his reactions and more ready to grasp and see a way out of the immediate impasse than the mystic. See if I can get there. The mystic or the occultist, because he thinks in terms of humanity. May I say that in here is a lesson for us. In what terms do we think? And now, maybe some 90 or 80 something years have passed since this was written. The disciples of the world, says DK, with their nicely formulated ideals and their neatly expressed idealistic concepts. Nicely and neatly? These words are arresting, may I say. So these disciples, DK goes on, are oft glamored by the future beauty because they are oblivious of the present opportunity. Oh, may I say that opportunity is still with us, dramatically so. Humanity is having to learn to respond to that opportunity. And a certain simplicity and selflessness will help us so to respond. Now, DK, going on, speaking of the idealists who remain so, without really seizing the day, we might say, many of them will find out later that they have been left behind as far as registering the new truths is concerned. May I say, that's a surprising statement, because so many idealists feel they are in possession of these newer truths, and more so than the man in the street. Well, there can be certain technicalities which they possess, but not that wide open simplicity that does get things done. And DK goes on to say, to this Christ referred when he said, it is not possible to put new wine into old bottles, for that which is old will be destroyed by the expanding new life. And, you know, in my view, I would add, and meanwhile, the old will be rendered useless. And the new, somewhat contaminated by the vestiges of the old. So that's our little segue. I like to do that because it gives a sense of continuity. Here we are basically finding ourselves on page 86. Not too much remains in this section 1 for us to consider. But that we would profit by considering it over and over again, and then finding a way to act on it so as to seize opportunity. There is no question about that, at least in my mind. Okay, so DK goes on. and says the following. The initiate, therefore, stands ready for what? Remember that every true disciple is a candidate for the initiation that lies ahead of him or her, and even the true aspirant has taken the first initiation. So let's just assume that the majority of us are at least initiates of the first degree. Hi, friends. I had a little delay there. But anyway, maybe I can reach the end of section 8 here. We will see what is possible, or part 8. So I was at that point to discuss the initiate, therefore, stands for what? And since all disciples are being prepared for initiation, it is a legitimate question. And he says, and let's see if we can say of ourselves, well, yes, I can do this, even if we're a probationary initiate of the first or second degree, for the instant recognition of what is new, for its immediate grasp, and the treading of the new step in the unfoldment of the pioneering human consciousness, for the revelations steadily and constantly presented of the new and superseding concepts. All right. So, may I say, these are the things the initiate stands for. And of course, it requires that open-mindedness, which probably a number of us have violated because we're holding fast to what we believe, because there's security in saying, well, I know, so I don't necessarily have to be open to all of these other things. So instant recognition of what is new, the immediate grasp, and notice the word immediate, for its immediate grasp, so that's a rapid response, isn't it? And the treading of the new step, that means actually doing it. The treading of the new step in the unfoldment, and notice, please, the word pioneering, in the unfoldment of the pioneering human consciousness. The initiate is, in this instance, a pioneer, doing something for the first time. And of course, we've been told that Aries, the sign of pioneering, is very much involved in impulsing the beginning of the New Age. So, for the revelation, he goes on to say, steadily and constantly presented. And I suppose this is to presented to human beings who can begin to bridge toward some kind of realization here of the new and superseding concepts. All right, that's pretty clear, isn't it? I'm in a bit of a tangle of wires here, just trying to work it all out so I can keep communicating with you. These concepts possess a dynamic, expulsive power. Now, Dihi is here talking about the new concepts which have to be recognized. These concepts possess a dynamic, expulsive power and satisfactorily meet human need in the immediate cycle. Now that's, I think, an important idea, because the new concepts really help us get rid of the old ones that have been acting as a prison and have been capturing our consciousness and making it incapable of moving ahead. So this initiate, DK goes on, he is ready for the instant relinquishing. You know, may I say, these are demanding requirements. If you think about that, he is ready for the instant relinquishing of all that seems futile and unnecessary and inadequate to the need of the hour, and for the reception of the power from on high which breaks and destroys that which has become crystallized. May I say that's probably the main problem, is the crystallization of the forms of thought and emotional response to which we adhere. So he is ready, says the Tibetan, for the reception of the power from on high, which breaks and destroys that which has become crystallized, which has served its purpose and become old and useless. And may I say that DK, when speaking of the current form of the Abrahamic religions, not so much the mystical side of them, he says they've all outlived their usefulness. They have no more real value in the locked and crystallized form in which they are presently expressed. This initiate, says DK, he is ready to work as a practical occultist, and not only as a mystical idealist. May I say that mystical idealism may remain with him, just the way Neptune remains with the individual who is beginning to cultivate the planet Uranus. So he didn't say not as a mystical idealist, but not only as a mystical idealist. He is ready to work as a practical occultist, this is what the Tibetan says, and not only as a mystical idealist, upon the levels of vision, as well as upon the levels of practical human affairs. This is key, a dual life. Well, let us say the masters too have a dual life, or live a dual life. They are, yes, oriented towards Shambhala, which orientation is not yet complete, and they are oriented towards humanity on a much lower turn of the spiral. So then we can ask ourselves as disciples, and every true disciple is at least a probationary initiate, looking forward to the next initiation and preparing for it. To what extent do we fulfill these requirements? That's what I'm saying. When we read what DK is saying, we have to ask, to what extent am I, the reader, the true aspirant, the real disciple, actually fulfilling what the master indicates? And wouldn't we say there's a kind of alert readiness to change, an alert readiness to change into an orientation which is more useful to the divine plan and to the great work than the one to which we had been adhering? Well, let me say, each one of us has to determine whether this is the case for ourselves. In our present condition of development. Now, DK goes on, I would suggest that your meditation process should be divided into two parts. There should be a definitely planned individual and group meditation, and also a methodical, note that word, a methodical cultivation of the life of spiritual reflection. May I say, I find this paragraph, or at least part of it here, very indicative and demanding thought. So one part of this meditation process is, whether it's your planned individual meditation, and he did give those meditations to his students, or whether a group meditation, which he also gave. So that's number one. And then what is he going to mean by the methodical cultivation of the life of spiritual reflection? Let's see what he means. So he does go on here, this spiritual reflection will foster the dual life, objective and subjective, of the disciple, whilst the more formal meditation would aid in the process of focusing the light of the soul in the brain. Remember, may I say, soul, mind, brain, that's the alignment that we so often seek to achieve, focusing the light of the soul in the brain, and thus lay the foundation for living enlightened soul service. Well, as long as we have in mind a dual life is expected of us, that we will be responsive to that which is above and help with that which is below. You know, the very first mantram we're given in the Arcane School, there comes a section in it that says, to look above, to help below, to dream not, nor to rest, to toil, to serve, to reap, to pray, to mount the cross, to tread the way, etc. So, spiritual reflection. I suppose it's an attitude of mind, it's a kind of orientation. Yeah. The spiritual reflection will foster the dual life. And may I say, I wonder how many of us are successfully living the dual life, really oriented towards that which is above in a way that is truly receptive, and yet working effectively on the outer plane. No matter what we may be doing on the outer plane, it's got to be effective, it's got to be in line with the plan, it's got to be part of the great work, however small it may seem when analyzed. So, okay, this spiritual reflection will foster the dual life. You begin to wonder, don't you, whether there's a being in cosmos that does not somehow live a dual life. Even the great universal logos is oriented towards that which may come from a trans-universal state, even while that great logos, greatest of all in any universe, manages and becomes all of the variety of that universe. And the formal meditation, he says, would aid in the process of focusing the light of the soul in the brain. And that's a necessity. Soul, mind, brain. So that the soul becomes a recognizable fact in our consciousness, and thus lay the foundation, and this is maybe the point, for living enlightened service. Now, there's a 1, 2, 3 about that, isn't there? When we're looking at living enlightened service, we don't have to look too far before we find the three aspects of divinity. The livingness close to the will, the enlightenment of the soul illumination, and the active service on the outer plane. One day, that will be an atmic quality in terms of, I think, subplane number 6 on the atmic plane. I hope that when we finish this kind of work, that our service definitely is increased, and our access to the higher impulses is also increased. Now, going on with DK, this service is only the expression upon the physical plane of soul attitudes and activities as the soul evidences them on its own level of consciousness. In other words, somehow we are bringing what the soul does on its own level, we're bringing that through. And what's going on the level of the soul is no longer such a mystery to us in speaking factually. We may have all kinds of concepts about what transpires on the level of soul, but it's the experience that is counting. Now, DK goes on and he says, one phase of this dual work, the reflective part, may I add, okay, one phase of this dual work, the reflective, works out in an increasing realization and expression of intentional living, or of life with a purpose. So right away, we can see that we are into or subject to the will aspect. Increasingly subject to, oriented towards, receptive of the aspect of will and of purpose. I had an old teacher once, and he would make some pretty astute commentary on the type of humanity which he saw living the normal life. And basically, he said, well, they're just waiting for someone to roll them into the grave. The implication there was, in my view, that they were not living a purposeful life. Of course, he was pretty strict. So when you got when he had the possibility of a student, he put that student through some paces. And sometimes the student just saw fit to argue with him and went away, you know. Couldn't quite stand the pressure. Now, if they couldn't stand the pressure from him, imagine trying to withstand the pressure from Master DK, a true master, who could at will study you with great accuracy from afar. Always there would be the sense that someone could be watching. I remember DK saying that in the future, people would lose the privacy in which to sin. And what that means to me is that telepathic rapport will have become so developed that people will pretty well know if they are at least of a certain rank of development what the other person may be doing or thinking. So anyway, DK is talking about one phase of the dual work. Leading to life with a purpose in, or what he calls intentional living. Is that it? Yeah. Intentional living. Now, again, you know, always check yourself. Are you really living the intentional life, or living intentionally and with a purpose? There's a triad of qualities, either purpose, will, and intention, or will, purpose, and intention. Intention is to me, the third aspect of that triangle. And purpose, for me anyway, is the second aspect of that triangle. So, the reflective work can work out in this way. And DK goes on to say, it, I suppose, the reflective part, it leads to a mode of living which is built upon a planned program which approximates itself as far as possible to the hierarchical plan and to hierarchical life impulses. Well, maybe we can never entirely reproduce in ourselves the hierarchical plan. We have but a fragment, and but perhaps we can register hierarchical life impulses. I wonder, do we realize behind these words with which many of us have been long familiar are some pretty rigorous expectations? Okay, now DK goes on. The second phase, I guess he seems to put this in the secondary position, or maybe just in terms of when it's carried out, this intentional living, reflective work is looking here like the first phase. The second phase, which is embodied in the formal meditation, is that of a definite and conscious withdrawal. Well, may I say, we are withdrawing from identification with the personality life, and we might say the personality life, which often is countering the life of the angel of the presence and the master. So a definite and conscious withdrawal. And DK goes on to say, if this is carried out correctly and with deliberation, which means, I suppose, with thoughtfulness and a well-deliberated attitude, plus regularity, he says, it will eventually bring about a most productive telepathic interplay between the disciples in a group and between the individual disciple, the master, and the larger ashram. And may I say that can be the Ray ashram, in which the master finds himself, or maybe we're talking about the hierarchy as a whole. So the second phase is here being discussed. And he closes the paragraph by saying, it will also make the disciple sensitive to the higher gift waves. Now, we've spent quite a bit of time already dealing with the factor of sensitivity. What it is, what it is not. And that's in some of the earlier programs. To think that there are these thoughts, these energies, circulating within the range of access, and yet we may know nothing about them or may not receive them, is not a desirable condition to sustain. So DK says, it will, this meditation, the formal meditation assigned by the master to the individual and the group, it will also make the disciple sensitive to the higher gift waves. The entire meditation, in its two parts, involves therefore the linking up of heart and head, of the mystic and the occult approach, and also of feeling and knowledge. So it seems clear that the meditations that he's talking about here are integrative. We know that in the individual disciple, the heart and head must be linked. We also know that in building the Antikarana by the many groups, in the new group of world servers, the heart and head center of Sanat Kumara are being linked. We know that Neptune and Uranus must be linked, and that under Venus, we might say, feeling and knowledge should be linked. And we know here that we need the telepathic interplay. I was hoping to be able to finish this section in one, but spontaneous meetings and upcoming program are not making that possible. Anyway, DK goes on to say, only from the heart center can stream, in reality, those energies which link and bind together. Well, that should make us want to involve the heart, definitely. In our individual and group meditations. Only from the heart center, which, may I add, has a Buddhic connection, can stream in reality those lines of energy which link and bind together. I think in a treatise on white magic, he tells us about the mind like a spinning flywheel, and how it casts off and throws to the side those who may approach, and thus maintains a kind of rotary motion. But since this heart energy is so important for linking, binding, I suppose we might say causing coherence and overall integrating and fusing, because of all that, DK goes on to say, it was for this reason that I have assigned certain meditations which stimulate the heart into action, linking the heart center between the shoulder blades to the head center through the medium of the higher correspondence to the heart center found within the head center, the thousand-petaled lotus. So DK has been preparing us, no question, as he works with the building of the Antikarana and so forth. Whoop. So in Master DK's six or seven meditations found in discipleship in the New Age Volume 2, he's building in us all the time the needed relationship between the centers, each other, and the various planes and points of tension. Now he says, this heart center, when adequately radiatory and magnetic, relates disciples to each other and to all the world. It will also, he says, produce that telepathic interplay, which is so much to be desired, and which is so constructively useful to the spiritual hierarchy, provided it is established within a group of pledged disciples, dedicated to the service of humanity. Then they can be trusted. Now, when, may I ask, can a disciple truly be trusted and not be a hazard? And DK points out that when the temptations in the desert are past, the disciple is no longer a hazard. So, let me say, the heart center is a very powerful and necessary center to be involved in this creating of cohesion and integration along the line of certain advanced meditations based on themes like isolated unity, inclusive reason, and presented attributes. So the heart center, may I say, is helping with the production of telepathic interplay. Then they can be trusted. Well, it impressed me when I was reading things of this nature. The word hazard impressed me. A hazard is a danger. The danger is to themselves, and the danger is to the work. And so the second degree becomes very important, because after that, Jesus or the Christ, or the combination of the two, betook themselves into the wasteland. And there encountered the devil of the rebellious personality. Now, of course, the result was a foregone conclusion. Even Master Jesus was already an initiate of the third degree, from a previous incarnation where he was Joshua the high priest. That's what we've been told. And the Christ was already the head of the spiritual hierarchy. So, in that sense, the devil, probably a much greater example of the devil, the world of flesh and the devil, spoke internally to the Christ from a very powerful level. The result was probably a foregone conclusion. He was going to make those enunciations about man does not live by bread alone, and get thee behind me, Satan, and thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God. The result was going to work out as it did, and was going to set a great example for those who go into the desert, but with, of course, much less initiatory status than was the case of the Christ, and even of Jesus. Going on a little bit here, one of the tasks of all disciples, says the Tibetan, is the evocation of the will aspect of the soul. The will is usually quiescent in its higher aspect until the man treads the path of discipleship and what phase of the path of discipleship is meant. A disciple stands, may I say, ahead of even the true aspirant. And the true aspirant has taken the first initiation. So as you tread the path of discipleship, you are definitely a first degree initiate, even as an accepted disciple, based upon your acceptances, you may still be a first degree initiate, but coming closer to that all-important ashramically relating second degree. So let's say that we may be talking about accepted disciples and higher, if the will aspect of the soul is to be called forth. And we can pause just for a moment here and see if we find that will aspect being called forth in us. I would suppose there are many ways that aspects of the will can be expressed without expressing the real spiritual will. The idea of fixed determination, the idea of living a purposeful life with intentional living, all of these are aspects of the will. But still, remember in the Garden of Gethsemane, the Christ, unsupported by his sleeping disciples, faced the agony of subjecting himself to the true divine will, admittedly a much higher will than we could think of receiving and responding to. So this question of accepting the will is not simply the statement to oneself, I will do it, you know. That might suggest a kind of fixed determination, but not that real willingness to abide by the divine purpose as it can reflect itself on our particular level of development. Now, DK kind of changes subject a little bit here. He says, you might ask, my brothers, of what use are these analogies and these items of information? They are of little technical use, the Tibetan says. They are of little technical use to you and really increase your responsibility. Because, may I say, if we know something, we are responsible to use it. Use the knowledge in the right way. And not just pile up the knowledge, you know. Master Moria, in his unique way of expression, has said that even a donkey can carry a library on his back. So that is not what we want to do with the amazingly organized and useful information which Master DK imparts. Going on with DK, if, however, they serve to establish a true recognition of reality, of synthesis, and of relation in the disciples' consciousness, they are then of real value. Now, as I read the words, I said, these are significant. And sure enough, Master DK does isolate these very words. Those three words, he says, reality, synthesis, relation, indicate the goal and the problem of the disciple, plus the resultant effect of the conscious, intelligent, spiritual work motivated by love. Reality. What is really occurring in the mind or in the outer work? Do the synthesis petals, which are unfolding to a degree with every one of the lesser initiations, do these convey to our consciousness the sense of that hard-to-define word, synthesis? And do we come into relation? Remember, on the 3 days that precede the Gemini full moon, what do we have? Love, resurrection, contact. The idea of relation is there. So these three words, what do they mean to us? I guess it's hard to realize that the knowledge that we accumulate does place us in a position of increased responsibility. But then they can have that good effect. There are many items of information which Master DK is conveying. And do we want to use them in the way they are intended to be used? Or do we just want to go on accumulating knowledge? Now that is a question to which we must address ourselves. Because let us say that what he imparts can be used either way. And maybe some of us have used that impartation in both ways. And it does, he says, constitute our problem. Is our sense of soul reality and beyond, I add the beyond, increased? Is that factor which reflects life, synthesis, that is, increased? Is our relation with each other enhanced? Telepathically, and do we begin to have a soul relationship with each other? I don't know how many people it would take Did I say people? I just don't know how long it would take, how much penetration into the true soul structure it would take, and then this mysterious factor of synthesis, which I correlate with the indigo ray. What does it take for the individual or the group to recognize these factors beyond the simply conceptual level? And notice here at the end, it's all got to be motivated by love. And that is the check-in which we can do. Is all this that DK is advising and which is to be used properly, is it motivated by love? What's the motivation behind studying so assiduously his words, his detailed knowledge? What really is going on there? I think I'll try to do one more paragraph here, which will take us well into page 88. And kind of end talking about danger and risk taking. So let's take a look here at what he says. In the New Age, as I've earlier pointed out, this is always repeated, may I say. In the New Age, as I have earlier pointed out, the keynote of the aspirant's progress will be the love, will be the love of humanity. The keynote will be the love. Of humanity. Now, I've managed to put in the wrong color there, but okay. Looks like I have devolved back into an earlier method. So, question yourself. I'll always be saying, question yourself, and I'll be saying that to my little self here. Is the keynote to my progress and to the group progress the love of humanity? One must, may I say, eliminate many non-essentials before this keynote for the true aspirant becomes the love of humanity, and not just the love of one's own progress, which can feed spiritual ambition and a spiritual type of egotism. Now, if this true love of humanity springs up in our heart, then the Tibetan goes on to say, this will indicate the awakening of the heart center. And I'm going to also try here to well, I better not doing so well making this the way I would like it to be. Maybe the only way to do it is to no color, and then try this once again. Sorry for this little technical delay. But anyway, this, what he's going to say is an important important matter. Let's see here. Yeah, okay, maybe I'll succeed now, even if just a little bit. This will indicate the awakening of the heart center. Now, this contrast that he brings out should be attended to. In the past and up until the last few years, now that can mean 1925, let's say, the keynote has been service, because if selflessly rendered, it embodies a technique which automatically brought the heart center into activity. All right. Now that is an interesting statement. True service rendered brings the heart center into activity. And then he says, it is love of humanity which is the major lack in the character of many disciples today. Now, really, we're going to have to pause on that one. That is of the most pressing importance. And we have to again measure ourselves in relation to it. It is love of humanity which is the major lack in the character of many disciples today. How much, may I say, could we ponder that statement? D.K. goes on to describe, they love those with whom they may be associated, or they love the work connected with the group endeavor, or they love their own nation. They may also love the ideal or theoretical, an ideal or theoretical assumption, but they do not really love humanity as a whole. Whoa. I have a feeling that is one of the most important things that D.K. Is saying here. And something that I think we should all ponder. Do I love humanity as a whole? It is a subtle thing and very elusive. D.K. has told us whom we do love. And it is, by and large, not humanity as a whole. Can we test ourselves on this? There are limits, he says, to their capacity to love, and it is the transcending of those limits which constitutes their main problem at this time. Main problem. It all comes back to love, and in D.K.'s ashram, one of the externalizing ashrams, right human relations, presumably based on love, will be paramount. They have to learn, says the Tibetan, that it is humanity which calls for their allegiance, their loyalty, and service. I would ask you, he says, I would ask you all, to ponder deeply on the above statements, for they embody the task ahead for you also as you seek to fit yourselves for the first or the second initiation. And so in this let's see here. I would ask you all to ponder deeply on the above statements, because for you also, they embody the task ahead. As you seek to fit yourself for the first or second initiation, it is humanity which calls for their allegiance, their loyalty, and their service. Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to, because the program is coming up quite shortly, I'm going to stop here. And this is, it doesn't leave much to do, but I have to stop here. So let's see what page we're on. Looks like, page 88. So I'll go back up here. Yeah. And will take us to 88, program number 37, and we will soon begin our final here in part 8. It'll probably be a much shorter program. I do like to stop at the logical points. So we will see. This is the end of program 37. And today is the 29th of August, and we're still on part 8, and we've gone from page 86 to 88, and we'll finish this section with program 38, and it'll still be part 8. And I don't know what day it will be, but whatever day it is, maybe today, who knows. But I'm just going to go up probably to 89 in the next section. So friends, Tuya and I wish you the very best in your assimilation of these really important ideas. And so does the whole communications team, trying to bring to you the ageless wisdom as fully as we possibly can, and in some degree of meticulous entirety, reflecting what the Tibetan has offered us. So we'll see you before long.